Again to badquaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. Today is Thursday, June 7th, 2012. That's hard to keep up with. They change it every day, you know. Anyway, I did not do a podcast yesterday. I have been trying to do one every weekday, and I have been consistently failing at that. And yesterday, I kind of had an excuse. I was building shelves and putting up new equipment and so forth to expand the badquaker.com office. So I was working on that pretty much all day and just completely blew my brain out and blew my joints and my back and everything. And before I realized it, I was just a kind of a walking idiot and couldn't figure out what I was saying or what I was doing, which happens to me pretty regularly. Anyway, so that's my excuse. That's why there was no podcast yesterday. And but however, I did have the wonderful opportunity to read a small book. It's called Stash Your Swag, and it was sent to me by the author of that book. And I'm going to put a link in today's show notes over at badquaker.com. Get over there and click that link, and that'll take you to the author's Amazon page, and you can scroll through there and see some of the different things that that are available. Stash Your Swag is a really good book. It has suggestions on places where you can hide things. And the suggestions are, you know, they're good suggestions and everything, but just reading the book was so fun. It was just like, I didn't want to put it down because it's very engaging, and it was just a fun read. It's not just a dry, you know, hide things here. It wasn't like that. It was just really good. I really enjoyed it. And you might recognize some of the other titles, like Catch That Collie is a child's book that from the same author, and Pirates of Savannah is a very popular one. A lot of people in the Liberty Movement are aware of Pirates of Savannah. Oh, and the same author, by the way, is the personality behind the Low Country Liberty Report and one of the podcasters over at Wheels Off Liberty. So if you're familiar with either of those, you'll know who I'm talking about. His name, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, is Taran Lupo. I believe that's the pronunciation, Taran Lupo. I don't know. I'm hoping to meet him at Porkfest in just a few days. Like, what is that? Like a week and a half? Like a week and a half. I'll be at Porkfest, and I'm hoping to meet Taran there. But you know, either way, my point being, Stash Your Swag. You got to read that. Get over to badquaker.com, hit the link to Amazon, and grab one of Taran's books, but especially Stash Your Swag, because it's a really fun read. So, okay, now, why were we talking about Stash Your Swag? Well, because in a previous podcast, Taran was listening to me talking about stash holes, and how prior to the state, I was going to make a point in that in a podcast, and then I kind of wandered and didn't finish my point. I have a tendency to do that, but Taran had heard me talking about that, and that's what inspired him to send me that book, Stash Your Swag. But anyway, let me try to make the point that I failed to make the other day in talking about stash holes. And you have to be careful how you say that, and especially in mixed company. But my point being that in areas before the state was birthed, before there was a state, you often find in different, you know, universally throughout different Stone Age cultures, each little farm will have its own stash hole to hide things. Now, this might be as simple as a root cellar, where you just stash food to get you through off seasons and winter and a bad year and things like that. But also, there would be specific places where you could stash, you know, extras, stash things. They would build, you know, holes into different places, into walls and so forth, where they could stash things so that if they did have thieves or whatever, because, you know, crime has always, as long as there's humans, there's crime. So there were places that they would hide things. And but the big change came when the state appeared. Stash holes became places to hide people. Because one of the characteristics of the state is it tends to go, even in its very, very, very early form, they needed to press people into service for the government. So, of course, that's slavery. But they would get their slaves by going to farms or areas either that were or had not yet been conquered by the local city state or whatever the form of government that was coming up at the time. But they would go to places and they would have a tendency to steal, you know, children mostly, but also young adults, because, you know, you don't want to steal an old person to take them away to labor. So you have a tendency to steal the kidnap, however we want to put it. The state would send their thugs out, and or if you prefer using the phrase, you know, a conscript, or if you want to call it, you know, pressed into service or drafted or whatever, it doesn't really matter. But either way, it's the state snatching away young people for work against their will, whether that be military or whether that be just labor or whatever. So communities had to tolerate this as the state began to develop. And one of the things that you see appearing in conjunction with the appearance of the state is that the stash holes would go from the size of, you know, to hide things like small amounts of grain or small amounts of food or, you know, jewelry or whatever like that. From small stash holes of that kind, they very quickly became stash holes to hide people in. Stash holes where you could access the person in there through some kind of a small opening to hand them things like food or whatever without exposing them. These start appearing around farming communities as the state appears. So we see that one of the things that is required as the state develops is slavery. And one of the ways that they would do it is go out to neighboring farms and just steal the young people off the farms. So, that finishes my thought that I didn't finish in talking about Jericho, is that was one of the things that you see there, is the transition from stash holes being places to hide little things to places to hide people. And I've talked about this before. If you're building a house, or if you're remodeling a house, you know, it takes such a small amount of preparation and a small, financially speaking, especially if you're doing the work yourself, it takes such a small amount of investment to build stash holes into your construction. And this can be small stuff like what Taryn talks about in Stash Your Swag, or it can be, you know, whole closet size or room size stash places. And you know, right now in America, there's very little need for that kind of thing, but that hasn't always been the case. If you watch some of the TV shows about the about Prohibition back in the like 20s and early 30s, there were things like that were thought of, and they were important, and they were built into buildings. And if you go back further to the early 1800s, having a place to hide runaway slaves and so forth was very important in construction, especially, you know, where I live in Western Ohio, was the town itself was founded by Quakers, and part of the earliest construction in the town was digging tunnels to connect houses so that they could move runaway slaves, so that when the bounty hunters would come into Ohio looking for runaway slaves, that were, you know, being moved to Canada on the Underground Railroad. When these thugs would come from house to house looking for runaway slaves, you could just slip them into your stash area, and if it looked like the thugs were going to, you know, actually search your house, you could just move them to the neighboring house, you know, to safety, rather than let them be caught and dragged back south again and across the border into Kentucky. So these houses still exist here in the town that I'm in Ohio. These houses still exist with tunnels underneath them and whole hidden rooms. When we first moved to the area, 15 years ago or so, we were looking around at different houses, where to buy and so forth. And one of the houses we looked at had a hidden room upstairs off of the attic that was not obvious to get to, and it was a very small, tight little hidden room that they could stash someone in, you know, very quickly and hide them like that. And then down in the basement, there was an area in the basement where they had dug out and had a more permanent hiding area where they could hide runaway slaves. It was really interesting. And this was just a regular house that was up for sale, you know, from the outside. It looked like every other of the old houses in the downtown area. But anyway, I didn't really mean to go into that depth of discussion on the topic, but since I didn't finish my thought from the other day, and I did want to emphasize, so because, you know, just because there's no need for stash places in a house today, at this moment, in whatever country you may be in, Canada, the U.S., maybe the U.K., you know, we've got quite a few downloads coming in from Netherlands and from Germany lately too. So, you know, I don't know if maybe there's an English speaking audience there that are interested in these podcasts as well. But no matter what country that you're in, at this moment today, right now, it may be safe, and you may not need stash places, or you may not need, you know, whole rooms to hide people in or whatever, because the state may be in a relatively peaceful condition right now. But if you think ahead for generations, I'm telling you, folks, things are going to get nasty at some point in time when the state gets close to its final breaths. The state is going to react very nasty. It's going to really get rough. And the state will lash out at everyone that it can. And so if we think of this stuff ahead of time and we prepare for it now, if you're building a building, if you're remodeling a building or whatever, it doesn't take that much to just add a secret room or add a secret chamber or add, you know, just stash spots for, you know, one wonderful thing is PVC pipe. I love PVC pipe. You can take a piece of PVC pipe, say, you know, anywhere from a foot long to like 3 feet long, or for our European listeners, a meter. You can take a piece of PVC pipe, glue a cap on one end, glue a screw-on cap on the other end, and then so that you can screw the cap on and off. It's actually a two-piece thing, but anyway, I won't get into that right. But and distract myself here. And then you just open up that screw-in lid or screw-in cap, and you can slide that thing full of money, full of jewelry, full of whatever. And there are all kinds of places, like in a basement or in an attic of a house, where you can attach that to an interior, you know, where it's behind a wall or covered or out of sight, and it'll look like just like the rest of the plumbing and so forth. You can, if you're creative at how you do that. And the same thing goes with a short piece of like a ductwork for like a forced air heating or cooling system. You can have a false section of that. I'm talking about if you're doing new construction or if you're rebuilding, you know, remodeling older construction or whatever. It takes very little effort to put these things, to incorporate these things into construction. And that's in addition to all the really cool stuff that's in Taryn's book in Stash Your Swag. So anyway, it's an interesting topic. And even if you don't have a need for it now, it's important to think ahead Well, here's a standard one in if you get onto the gun, you know, among the gun fanatics and so forth on the internet, you'll see a regular thing where people use PVC pipe. You get a larger piece of it. Typically, you would use the lighter kind, like a drainage pipe, not necessarily the high pressure kind. But you have to get up around a 6 or 8 inch diameter, and cap that dude on one end. Put a removable plug on the other end, and if you get one long enough, you can slide an entire SKS rifle into one. And you just take a post hole digger and find a nice secluded place in the woods, and you can put an SKS and about 1,000 rounds or so of ammo, and no one will know it's there except you and whoever you show your map to, because we are going to draw maps to things like this, right? Okay, so that's a little paranoid rambling there, but sometimes it's fun to think about. One of the things I wanted to cover today, though, is in reference to government wasting money. That's low-hanging fruit, isn't it? That's an easy one to pick on. I have talked before about here in the town that I'm in, they decided that it was important to rip up one of the two busiest streets in town, and they tore out about a 4-mile section of it and completely repaved it. Total of, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, like 8 lanes. This includes a full-size, not 8 driving lanes, 2 northbound lanes, 2 southbound lanes, interior turn lanes, and full-sized shoulders, wide enough to both park and drive on each side. So, nice, big, wide, very, very busy street that goes north out of town and taking most of the non-freeway traffic in and out of town. And they decide to rip the thing up from end to end and repave it, even though part of it was only a couple years old and none of it was in bad shape at all. There was no part of this street that actually needed to be bothered in any way. It was in really good condition, but they came in with their grinders and they ground up all of the pavement, and completely repaved the whole 4 miles. Now, why would they do that? Why would they destroy a perfectly good road and then build a new road? Well, it's because that's stimulus money for you. That's the way these people think. This is the broken window fallacy taken to its logical end. They actually think that they're creating wealth by destroying a road and then rebuilding it again. Now, that's the kind of stupidity that you get when you have government. Now, from the city's point of view, there was a different motivation. There, the local city council here and the local mayor. And I say this because this is often the case. If you get involved in local politics, I bet you'll find exactly the same in your town as I find here. The Springboro City Council, that's the town I'm in, Springboro, Ohio. The Springboro City Council are not bright people, and the mayor is an idiot. Now, that being said, they still are smart enough to know free money when they see it. And when politicians can get a whiff of free money, it's like a hound dog after a rabbit. So why in the world would the locals want, the local city council and the local mayor, why in the world would they want to destroy 4 miles of a perfectly good road and disrupt traffic and disrupt all of the business for all of the different businesses on that road? Why would they risk angering all those business people and all those voters to rip up a perfectly good road and replace it? Certainly, in the eyes of the city council and the mayor, certainly they're not thinking of any goofy Keynesian economics when they're doing that. They don't know who Keynes was, and they don't know anything about economics. So what's their motivation? Sure, it's goofy Keynesian economics on a federal level to fund stuff like this, but on the local level, they're just not bright enough to know these things. So what was the motivation of the city council? Well, that's easy enough. First off, we have to keep Uncle Larry's construction company funded, don't we? If we don't keep Uncle Larry's construction company funded, then your three nephews and your cousin and your brother-in-law, who won't normally lift his finger to work, they won't have the cushy jobs at Uncle Larry's construction company where they pretty much just sit around and get paid to do nothing. But as long as we can keep federal funding coming into the city with federally funded jobs, then Uncle Larry can overemploy all of your lazy family, see? So that motivates a city councilman to get that federal funding flowing so that he can give it to his stupid Uncle Larry's construction company. And the other thing is, we have to maintain those campaign contributions from the local, you know, ice chest movers union or whatever. We're not gonna have campaign cash flowing into the mayor's coffers if he doesn't support the local ice chest movers union. Otherwise, you know, we're gonna have scab construction guys out there carrying around ice chests. We can't have that. We have to, you know, we have to get the mayor to take that campaign contribution, so then the kickbacks can go back towards the union officials. And we got, you know, to make sure all those ice chest carriers at Uncle Larry's construction company all stay in the union and all pay their dues. So it's a big loop, you know. Well, and then there's the other aspect of it. Now I said that the city council here are not that bright and the mayor's an idiot. And yet they're smart enough to know the layers and layers and layers of federal funding that come through when you're a city or a county or a local state or whatever, and you want some of those federal funds. So I'm gonna zip over to and here's one other thing. I saw what sparked me to talk about this today is a story that was on the Drudge Report, and let me bump over there to it really quick so I have the actual story in front of me. It says the federal government is sitting on $70 billion of unspent cash. And the story says, this is from, who is this? Oh, the Washington Times. And it says that, it gives an example. It says the $70 billion is money that's been unspent for years, including $13 billion in road building money that was earmarked. And then eventually the projects died out or whatever and didn't get spent. It gives one case that says, in one case, there was $29 million was dedicated to a highway interchange in Newport News, Virginia. But in 1998, the state abandoned the project, and then the congressman who sponsored the earmark died in the year 2000. So the money just sat there. So the congressman got the money earmarked for an interchange project that wasn't important. It clearly wasn't important because it got dropped. And then so after he got the funding, then the project got dropped and he died, and the money's just sitting there. So we actually have federal government that is so intent upon, you know, throwing money in different directions to try to win the support of different key elements out there in industry. And they're so inefficient that they don't even follow up on where the money is going to. As long as they can brag and say, well, you know, I got money to this program or I got money to that program, then they can get the donations they need to run another campaign. But the government is so inefficient that it doesn't even follow up on these things and make sure that the money actually, you know, goes to whatever project that it is. And reading that this morning, it got me thinking about the locals here, and they're tearing up a perfectly good road. And I thought, I wonder how much funding, I wonder how many programs there are that a city could tap into for something like this. So I did a little bit of searching, and I'm over at the Federal Highway Administration's website from the U.S. Department of Transportation at fhwa.gov. And on the page that I'm on, it's titled Bicycle and Pedestrian Program. Bicycle and Pedestrian Provisions of the Federal Aid Program. And it's a huge page of different ways that cities and counties and states and municipalities and whatever can get more and more layers and layers and layers of federal funding for pedestrian and bicycle projects and for highways that support these bicycle and pedestrian projects, including bridges and all kinds of things. And I start scrolling down this and I started to make a list of how many different ways there are to fund this, and I was going to read down the list, but it just got too long. I mean, it got ridiculous. I thought, I'm going to lose listeners if I just sit here naming government program after government program after government program for 15 or 20 minutes. So just to give you an idea of some of this stuff, there's the Federal Aid Highway Program, the National Highway Systems Fund, the Surface Transportation Program. There's Transportation Enhancement Activities. And all these have, you know, letters associated with them, like, you know, like, because the government loves to name things like FBI, CIA, and so these are like the Transportation Enhancement Activities is called TEA or T, and so you pluralize that and you refer to the Transportation Enhancement Activities as T's, and that's government lingo. That's how they pretend to be cool by using abbreviations like that. Here's the Hazard Elimination and Railway Highway Crossing Program. Here's the Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Improvement Program. Here's the Recreational Trails Program. Here's the Federal Lands Highway Program. Here's the National Scenic Byways Program and the Jobs, Access, and Reverse Commute Grants Program. Yeah, this just goes on and on. I'm not kidding. I could read these things, titles like that, for 15 minutes on how many separate programs there are to fund these kinds of projects. So you have a city like mine that has a perfectly good road, and it just so happens that perfectly good road is not an area where a sane person would want to ride a bicycle. In our city here in Springboro, there are little pockets of neighborhoods that are detached from each other, and because it was built in a series of, there was a project built in the late 60s and early 70s, and then in the going back further, there was a project built in the late 50s, early 60s, and there was another section of town built in the 1940s. And another section of town built in the 1930s. And each of these is separate little neighborhoods that are all sort of connected by the streets. But in order to move from one to the other, if you're on a bicycle, it's really inconvenient to try to get from one of these little neighborhoods to the other, because you have to cross streets that are not bicycle friendly at all. So they come in, and of all the places that they could put bicycle lanes, they put them in this 4 mile section that they ripped out and rebuilt. But that doesn't connect any of the neighborhoods to each other. It simply goes straight out of town from the middle of town. So, for instance, if they really wanted to help with encourage bicycling in town, then what they would want to do is have, add a bicycle lane, say, from one of the more distant neighborhoods up to the high school or up to the junior high or to one of the grade schools. That would be a good path to build a bicycle lane. Or they could build bicycle lanes to connect the various parks that we have in town. That would be a good project that would encourage bicycling. Or they could build bicycle lanes from the main neighborhoods in town towards where the main employers are in town. See, that would be a smart thing to do for bicycles. But the particular street that they got the federal funding to rip the pavement out and put in all new pavement, including two new bicycle lanes, Nobody would really want to ride their bicycle on that road because it doesn't. It's that for a bicycler, there's no convenient way to start on that road, and there's no convenient and there's no real goal to riding down it. So, of all the roads in town that they could have put a useful bike lane, that would probably be the last one that it would make sense to put a bike lane on, but. It's the one that they, you know, they calculated that they could get the most funding for using all these programs. And so, of course, that's the one that they ended up ripping out, disrupting traffic, and putting a totally useless bicycle lane on it. Thank you very much, federal funding. So it's kind of like if you go with the broken window fallacy, you know what I should talk about? I should cover the broken window fallacy. Most libertarians already know this, but when I get back from the break, I'm going to break for a commercial. When I get back from the break, we'll cover the broken window fallacy. And then I want to go on and talk about the next subject today, which is some stuff by Herbert Spencer. So stick with me through the break. I'll be right back in about 2 minutes, and we'll cover the broken window fallacy and Herbert Spencer, and maybe we'll even get into Ron Paul.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help BadQuaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial break. If you notice, we switched things around a little bit there. I'm trying to give you a little bit of a break on what the commercials sound like. Now, I wanted to touch on the broken window fallacy, so that we know, so everyone is on the same page with this. This comes to us from Frederick Bastiat, who was a politician, but he was also an economist and an early, what you might call a proto-libertarian or a proto-Austrian economist in the 1800s in France. And he made some wonderful observations, and he has a couple of good books. But without really getting into all that, I'm just going to lay out the broken window fallacy for you. So, The way it goes is like this. The storekeeper, and I'm going to mess up the broken window fallacy story. Okay, so a careless child throws a rock or throws a ball or whatever, it doesn't really matter how you tell the story, and breaks the window of a shopkeeper. So the shopkeeper looks, he says, oh no, I've got a broken window. Well, people pat him on the back and say, don't worry, now you've actually stimulated the economy because you've given a job to the glazier, the person who, they used to glaze windows when they would put them in. They would put them in with a clay mixture, but so they called them window glazers. But either way, it's the window repairman. So the people encourage the shopkeeper, and they say, don't look at it as a broken window. Look at it as a you know, a boost for the economy, because now the window repairman gets to come out. He gets to replace the window. You get to pay him. He'll take that money and he'll spend that money. He'll maybe even buy something from your shop, or he'll, you know, maybe buy some shoes for his kids, or he'll do something with that money. And he wouldn't have normally had that money. And so that's, you know, that's the idea, that by breaking this window, you've stimulated the economy, and you're, you know, you're creating a job for the window repairman, and also for whatever he spends that money on, that money will then go and stimulate the economy further as it goes from hand to hand. And so, you know, that's the reason that people will come out, these government people will come out and grind up a perfectly good highway and pay to repave it, thinking that they're stimulating the economy. Or that's why, you know, a president will confiscate massive amounts of money, tax money from working people all over the country, and hand it to a company like General Motors, so that they're stimulated and so that they can, you know, produce. Well, but here's the problem, and Bastiat shows this in his example of it. When you break the window of the shopkeeper, yes, hires the window man to come out and fix the window. But that money didn't just magically appear out of nowhere when the window got broke. That money had to come out of the pocket of the shopkeeper. That means, yes, okay, the window repairman now has some money, but that money came directly out of the pocket of the window of the shopkeeper. That's money he no longer has. That's shoes he can't buy for his children. That's money he can't spend on some other project. Just like, you know, the idea that the window repairman is going to spend that into the economy, but that's taken from the shopkeeper, who could have just as easily spent that into the economy. Or he could have saved that and, you know, developed it for later other projects that might have been more productive. So really and truly, when you smash the window and then hire the window repairman to come and fix it, you're not stimulating the economy by the price of the window. You're destroying the price of one window, and then taking that price out of the pocket of somebody else in order to pay for your project. So in the case of the road, of the grinding up and replacing a perfectly good road, you're not stimulating the economy by however much you spent on that. You're stealing that amount from the taxpayers and then using it in an extremely inefficient fashion back into the economy. So you haven't stimulated anything. You've actually hurt the economy by doing this, by taking the money out. And it's not just a zero sum gain in something like this, because when you take the tax money from the taxpayers, it doesn't then go directly into the hands of the construction project. It's got to wash through layers and layers and layers of bureaucrats who do nothing but shuffle papers and talk to each other constantly. So you're actually using more, you're wasting a lot of money that is being taken out of the taxpayers' pockets that could have been used directly into the economy, but it's not. You're taking it and paying bureaucrats with it that don't produce anything positive for the economy. So that's not stimulating the economy. That's just burning up funds that you've stolen from the taxpayers. So let's just use some hard figures here. Let's say I don't know any of the actual cost on this road project here in town. It would be easy to look up, but you wouldn't get real numbers anyway, so it really doesn't matter. But let's just use nice, round, easy figures. Let's say it cost $1 million, and I'm sure it cost way more than $1 million, but let's just say it cost $1 million to put in the 4 miles of pavement and put up all the signs that you need for the bike lane and the special painting that it needs and the little reflectors and all the little doodads. And plus, you know, they go through and put in the center divider, and they put flowers in there, and all, and they're really spending the money in doing this. So $1 million is not even a realistic number, but it's just a round number that we can use. So let's say they have $1 million they're going to spend on this. That's not $1 million they took from taxpayers. In order to get $1 million to spend on the road project, they would have had to have taken far more maybe, you know, many millions just to finally get it washed down to the point of where 1 million actually gets back to the road project. I don't know exactly what the proportions are. If you think of charities, think of some of the major charities that are out there. And for there's a lot of data on the internet to support this as well. But for on your average charity, for every dollar that you give to that charity, it's very common for the charity to use maybe 50, 60 cents of that dollar just maintaining the charity, maintaining advertising for the charity, paying their executives in the charity, paying the workers in the charity, putting up advertising, putting up all the different activities that they do to fundraise and all these kind of things. It's very common for a charity to spend 50, 60, or even 70% of its income on things that do nothing for the charity. So in other words, if you're going to give a dollar to Feed the Homeless program, there's a Feed the Homeless program, and you're going to give a dollar to it. Well, you can almost perfectly expect that if you give a dollar to the Feed the Homeless program, 50 or 60 cents of that dollar will go to the people doing the program, not feeding the homeless. So you would be better off to take your dollar, go down to the grocery store, buy some bread and some lunch meat, make them some sandwiches, and go down and hand them food than you would going down and handing a dollar to an organization that feeds the homeless. Because it's a direct payment directly to the homeless person in the form of the food. Whereas, giving it to the charity, first, it has to filter through the charity. The charity itself has to support itself. Then it goes and, with the leftovers, helps out whatever the point of the charity is. And that's in the private sector. When you introduce government, then you introduce an almost unlimited layers of bureaucrats that all have to be fed before that money ever gets to the end purpose. So whatever you're taking from the source is, proportionately huge compared to the amount that actually gets to the end. So when we use our broken window fallacy as an example, that does apply in real life, except when you think of government doing the same thing, when government breaks the window and then they need to tax the shopkeeper to pay for the window, they're going to have layers and layers and layers of bureaucracy that are not adding anything, that are just standing around regulating how the window repairman is, what kind of glasses he has to wear and if he's wearing a hard hat or not and if he has to have steel-toed shoes and what kind of truck that he has to bring the window there with. You've got layers and layers of bureaucrats all interfering with the whole process and all getting a chunk of that money. So, to build a road like this, or to actually just destroy and then repair a road like this, takes way more money than what is seen. And that goes to another Bastiat point, which he makes in his book, That Which Is Seen and That Which Is Not Seen. Anytime government takes an action, there's that which is seen and there is that which is not seen. And almost always, if that which is seen is good — that was Baggy, she just charged right past the microphone and stomped on my keyboard — if that which is seen is good, the odds are there's stuff going on that you don't see that's really bad. Okay, so that's our Bastiat lesson for today. Now, I promised that we'd talk about Herbert Spencer as well. So let's get over there and start talking about Herbert Spencer. Much like Bastiat, Herbert Spencer is an old dead dude. If you want to see what Herbert Spencer looks like, go to badquaker.com and look at the faces across the front of the page at badquaker.com. And Herbert Spencer is the kind of angry looking guy. The first one is — I'm going by memory, I don't have the page up in front of me — but the first one to the left is Lysander Spooner, and then is Henry David Thoreau, and then the third one in from the left is Herbert Spencer. And he's kind of leaning back a little bit and looking to the side with sort of a gruff look on his face. And I like that picture of Herbert Spencer because I think it really captures, of course, you know, who knows, time washes things out. But reading his work and reading about him, he seemed to me to be a very angry person, very upset person, not at all happy. And I could be way wrong on that. But that's also the impression I get from that picture. So that's why I like that picture of Herbert Spencer. If you look on the same list across badquaker.com of the same faces, you're going to see Murray Rothbard over there with a big smile on his face. And you think about almost any picture of Murray Rothbard that was taken under casual settings, and he had that big goofy smile on his face. And you can just sense in his writings the joy that comes out of him. But and I'm saying all that, and there's a good possibility that all that imagery on badquaker.com is going to change in the near future because we are working with a company that's going to be hopefully rebuilding all that, although I've been dragging my feet and not getting them the information they need to actually update the website. So who knows? Who knows what that's going to look like in months from now? But anyway, okay, so Herbert Spencer. Now, Herbert Spencer has a book called he's dead now. He had a book called The Study of Psychology. And it's a very important book to the Liberty Movement. In it, he talks about something called the Great Man Theory. And the Great Man Theory was very popular in the 1800s. And now you don't hear much talk about it, but it's, I think it's just quietly, generally believed among people. And the Great Man Theory... is it's generally used to lavish praise upon some hero, some president, or some dictator, or some emperor, or whatever. You know, a good example is Abraham Lincoln. People lavish praise upon Abraham Lincoln and tell what a great man he was and how he was the man of the hour and all this kind of thing. They, of course, ignore what a horrible, nasty, hate-filled human being that Abraham Lincoln was, and they just go with the hero worship. And the hero worship alone should be enough to cause a person to look at the great man theory and say, I don't know, there's something not right about this. Even without thinking it all through, the way Herbert Spencer really takes it apart and looks at it, without going to all of that effort, when you hear people praising one human being to such a great extent, it's a real good idea to just stop and ask yourself, why are we lavishing all this praise on a human being? Is this really a good idea? So whether you're, you know, I think right after 9/11 happened in 2001, right after the towers were attacked and all that, there was just an unbelievable amount of hero worship with George W. Bush, and it was very unsettling. It was kind of like, you know, well, it was creepy, was what it was, and a lot of that fell apart by about 2006 or so. People started to see, you know, how bad he had fouled things up and the vast amount of money that he had spent and the fact that he had destroyed, even his own party was abandoning him, and, you know, things were looking pretty bad. By 2008, his party had pretty much, was a walking joke. You know, that's really how you could portray the Republican Party in 2008. But early on, when they were still lavishing praise upon him, when he could do no wrong in the early days of his presidency, it was just really creepy, you know. And this is, you see this a lot in politics. This was Ronald Reagan. The amount of hero worship with Ronald Reagan was amazing. For some, Bill Clinton, you know, had that same level, still does have that same level of hero worship. Like he, you know, if it weren't for him, then we would have had this or that, or, we would have been worse off in some way. But in fact, what Herbert Spencer points out is that people are a product of their time. People have a tendency to become what they need to become in order to, you know, according to a lot of things, according to who their parents were, how they were raised, what kind of environment they were in their whole life, and what the circumstances of the current activity in society is. This is what develops a person to be the kind of person that they are. It's not because they're some kind of special creation that they, you know, that, you know, like Achilles it was special from birth, supposedly, and you know, right up through his life, he was a special hero that had this special purpose. Or, you know, or Ulysses, same kind of a story, or, you know, it doesn't matter who your hero is, you build this myth about around them that they, you know, were destined, or they were special, or they were created specifically to be this person in this time, or whatever. But all of that, as you break it apart logically, and Herbert Spencer does this in his book, as you break it apart logically, the whole argument falls apart. And you're left with the fact that every single human being is a product of their genetics, a product of their upbringing, a product of their family life, a product of the society that they grew up in. And they let's jump over to Ron Paul. I hear people just lavish praise on Ron Paul constantly. And people that ought to know better are doing this and saying how Ron Paul has done all these great things with the Liberty Movement, and how we wouldn't be where we are without Ron Paul, and Ron Paul is what has provided the leadership to get the Liberty Movement in the position that it's in. And all these things are based on the fallacy that Herbert Spencer has disproved. Ron Paul is a man. He is a human being. He's no different than any other human being. Now, throughout Ron Paul's rise, his meteoric rise, you might call it, from really, you know, he appeared on the scene for me in 1988 as the Libertarian candidate. That's when I first encountered, when I first found out about Ron Paul. But in 1988, there really wasn't a market for Ron Paul. Most of what Ron Paul was saying to a lot of people sounded kind of like empty echoes of some of the things that Ronald Reagan had been saying that Ronald Reagan did not produce on, that Ronald Reagan, you know, just used as talking points, and they never got any further. So for a lot of people to hear Ron Paul saying these things in 1988, there was just no market for it. Now, that changed slightly during the 1990s, and, you know, for a while there was even less of a market for, you know, what Ron Paul was saying. Now, all this started changing, really. You know, Ron Paul started really talking about booms and busts openly, with more and more people listening, around just a little bit before 2000, because there was such an obvious bubble forming at the time. And then he got some credibility at that time and some notoriety. But it wasn't really until around 2005 or 2006 when he really started warning about the housing bubble and people started to listen. So that then by 2008... he had developed a pretty, you know, well-known voice by 2008. And, of course, the presidential elections in 2008 helped him a lot. But you have to keep in mind that you can't look at Ron Paul using this great man theory that he was destined, or he was created for this purpose, or he has some special anointing of some kind, or he has some special knowledge of some kind. No, what you have is you have a market for what Ron Paul is talking about. And if, you know, by some freak chance that we wouldn't have had a Ron Paul in 2006, 2007, 2008, then someone else would have filled that Ron Paul market. You see, it's the market that drives the need for a person like that. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about, you know, Samuel Adams and in the 1770s, or if we're talking about, you know, Thomas Jefferson in the 1770s, or if we're talking about any other person in history that you think was absolutely critical to that, to the events happening at that time. Well, actually, if there's a market for a leader for a particular movement, then that market will, the market will be filled. Someone will fill that need. That's how markets work. Now, markets don't always produce the exact best product, or actually, it's according to how you measure the best, because, you know, that's such a vague term. So, is Ron Paul the absolute best person to fill the market for Ron Paul? We have a market for Ron Paul, but is Ron Paul the best person to fill that market? Well, there's no way to determine. If there was no Ron Paul, then who would be filling that market? Is it, would it be Tom Woods? Would it be, you know, Peter Schiff? Would it be somebody else? Who knows? But somebody would fill that market. There would be someone doing what Ron Paul is doing. And unfortunately, people would be worshiping him as a hero, or her as a hero. But so the point is not to have your focus so much on one person. It doesn't matter who that person is, but the point is to not have your focus on that one person, and it's to focus on what the market is demanding. And the market is demanding a move towards liberty, and a knowledge of liberty, and an understanding of the things that Ron Paul talks about. So in November, very shortly from now, the whole Ron Paul campaign thing is going to be over, and Ron Paul will never again run for another office, or at least we're told that. And at that time, it's going to be kind of weird for all the Ron Paul followers who really, really believe he's going to go into the convention in November and win it and win the presidency and fix all the problems of the world. Well, he's not going to. I mean, he's just not going to. Now, a lot of people in the Ron Paul movement know that. And they understand that the message is what's important, not the man. But not everybody in the movement knows that. There is way too much great man worship in the Ron Paul movement. And it's really important that as that, I've called it a Ron Paul bubble before. I've referred to it in that way. And it's really important that when that Ron Paul bubble pops, that all of us together who see the importance of the movement and see Ron Paul is simply a man in the movement, it's really important for us to reach out to those people, those Ron Paul followers who have built him up to be that great man, thinking that he has been placed in this time for this reason. Well, he wasn't. He's just a man. And if it weren't for Ron Paul, it would be somebody else. And after November, when the Ron Paul bubble pops, and whoever wins the election, it's important to pick up the cause and move on without the man. Now, that doesn't mean we exclude Ron Paul, but it means we have to move on with this cause without Ron Paul, without him as all the focus of everything that has to be to come. Okay, that's all I've got time for today. So for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And if you're at Porkfest this year, look me up. I'll be there. Thanks a lot, folks. Goodbye.
This is the Central Scrutinizer. We're working very hard to spend your tax money to keep you from hearing things like freedomfiends.com. That's why we're very upset about freedomfiends.cz. Freedomfiends.cz is a Liberty Media archive of Freedom Fiends material hosted in the Czech Republic. FreedomFiends.cz is outside the jurisdiction of the Watchers, who employ me, the Central Scrutinizer, to keep you from hearing things that might make you think. My fellow scrutinizers and I do not want you to visit FreedomFiends.cz. Do not visit freedomfiends.cz.